Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Mr. Keith Fielder, ag agent in Putnam and Hancock counties in Georgia. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hello, Jay. Morning.
How's everybody doing today?
Good.
I'm doing well.
We are in Des Moines, Iowa right now, recording at the National Ag Agents Association. This will be aired a little bit later in the year, but for those folks that are interested, it is mid-August, and it is mid-wonderful.
Yeah, I guarantee
yes,
you.
Yes, it is.
In the temperatures. We've got a guest here with us today from Georgia, and I'm sure he's welcoming the change.
I did. I stepped off the plane yesterday, and I wondered where spring went, and I found it. But I talked to my secretary this morning, and she said it was already 87 degrees at 9 o'clock Eatonton, Georgia, and she said the humidity was about 80%. And I said, I'm not even going to tell you what it is up here. And she says, I already looked.
Yeah, I'm looking right now, and the high is what, 75 today, and the low is 62.
One thing I did see this morning, I walked out of my hotel room to head this way. We're some of us are scattered around different parts of the downtown area here, but. Out in the hallway, somebody in my hotel had attempted to get themselves a dip of snuff. And they had dropped a couple of their snuff pouches in the middle of the hallway. And I thought, you know, I'm not all that far from home after all.
There's some of us all over, Jay.
That's exactly right. We yep. It's kind of like breadcrumbs. I thought Hansel and Gretel left that so I could find my way home.
I can guarantee you can find good people anywhere you go. And I was over in Ireland a number of years back and had been invited to come over there and do a bee talk and judge at one of the ag festivals that they have, a huge one in England, Great Yorkshire Festival. And we came out of the airport I can't think of the name of the town there, a little town we flew into. And when we got outside, they had the road blocked off. So I pull up in this little dairy and I was looking at the volume of hay this guy had cut and was looking out there, and he kind of strolls up and he looks in the window and he says, can I help you? And I told him what we were in, we'd gotten lost, and he goes and he just starts off, and I'm looking and I said, you know, what kind of hay is it? And he told me, and I asked him what his yield was, and next thing I know, we had spent an hour and a half just talking farming, and the guy didn't know me from Adam.
Yeah. Right.
And able to converse intelligently, you know, with him. And I mean, it was just, and I turned around, I looked at my wife, and she's like, you know, what can you say?
That's right. Yeah.
I had a similar experience one time up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We were in Wisconsin when the county agents national meeting was held in Green Bay. And one day, me and another agent, Pat Hardesty, who y'all know, he's the ag agent in my home county. We got out and just went riding around. And we ended up in the UP and was riding along. And a lot of forages in that area. And there was a guy cutting some alfalfa, self-propelled forage harvester. This 18 or so years ago now. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, I always wanted to run one of them things. He said, well, let's go back. He said, I bet he'd let you. So we turned around, went back, pulled up in the field, and we got out and watched the guy for a little while. And finally, he stopped when he was in the near the road and got out on the platform, asked if we could help us. And I told him who I was and what we were up there doing. He said, climb in. So we cut hay for about 30 minutes, and then I got out, and the other agent got in, and we
really?
Took turns. Yeah, I mean, it just that's the way good folks are, especially in agriculture. We all speak a lot of different languages, or maybe different dialects, but all speak the same language.
That's right.
So, Mr. Keith Fielder, guest with us here today. Keith, just tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your programs. First of all, I guess I should say, how Keith and I kind of got associated with one another.
I'm not sure I need to hear this story.
Well,
is it PG or
it's
is it
G? It's G.
It was honest.
Okay.
You know, everybody knocks on social media nowadays for all the things that we see that aren't wholesome in the world anymore. But Keith's an outdoorsman like myself, and we both are members of different groups. And like a lot of times, you just end up friends with people on Facebook that you don't really know, but you come to know. And we had commented back and forth about different things at different times. And one day he just puts a post up that he had been working with some master gardeners, I believe it was. May have been some beekeepers, but I think it's master gardeners. And I looked at that real hard and I thought, surely he's not an extension agent. So I sent him a message and asked.
Yeah, you did. Who are you?
And come to find out, we're both county agents. And that's kind of how we first got associated. Yep. And then met at the national meeting and have gone from there. But that, if anybody wants to ever hear something good that come out of Facebook, that was one thing. But Keith, glad to have you here. Just tell us a little
good
bit about
yourself.
Here. And geographically, where are Putnam and Hancock counties?
We are in north side of middle Georgia. If you want to kind of pin us down on a map, we are southwest of Atlanta, about 90 miles. We've got two big hydroelectric impoundments there in our county, Lake Sinclair and Lake Oconee. Oconee tends to attract high-dollar real estate. Sinclair was built in the 50s, and it's, you know, now they're building it up quite well now, but it used to be the place where they had the old single wide trailer and
fish camp
type thing. And there's still a lot of there, but that's the poor lake, and then Oconee's the rich lake. And they've changed the way we do things around there a good bit over the years. I've been in Putnam County since 1998. Which is kind of rare, I guess, for agents now to stay in one place that long. But the system we work in Georgia really doesn't encourage you to move around a lot. We've got a public service promotion process that will pay you if you stay in one place. So we like it. It's a great little community and a lot like the one I grew up in Blackley County in the south end of the state. And then work in Hancock across the river. And it's really a lot different county. It's one of the poorer counties in the state, so whenever I cross over, I sort of have to change my mindset and my recommendations and what I do. I'm an agent generalist. I do a little bit of everything. I work with beef cattle producers. I work with row croppers. We have a little row crop land, most of it in support of forages. Corn silage and cereal grain silages in my counties. Work with poultry producers, a little bit on nutrient management issues. We've got some dairy left. Putnam was a huge dairy county. It was number one dairy county in the state for a long, long time. And we're down to about four dairies now. Just seeing that go away, of course, land prices in our county make it hard for that to continue on. I work with homeowners. We got a big community there around the lake. Well, I say big, it's 20. If you look at both counties, there's about probably 35,000 people right there, which for our area of the state is big. Mm-hmm. But I've got a lot of retired people in that community there. My Master Gardener program's been a big thing for me over the years. Look at about 100 active master gardeners working there in our program. We've run over 200 through it over the years. Mm-hmm. And they have been a real, real bonus for me as far as a support base and just good help and good people.
Mm-hmm.
Great support group. I do a lot of work with landowners as far as wildlife and food plot work. Timber management. We do a lot of water quality work in our community. I've been a part of several projects, and we've got one now we're building with Georgia Power to work with the lake community. So, and then years ago, they decided that all us extension agents in Georgia needed to have a specialty. And I'm walking through the day, we were kind of deciding where we were going to be pigeonholed. And
voluntold to do something.
Yeah, voluntold to do something. And that was kind of the way we were looking at it. And I had done a lot of, in a career previous to extension, I'd worked with Georgia Department of Agriculture, and I was a pesticide use specialist. And I was afraid they were going to, you know, like, oh, you're going to be the pesticide guy. Yeah. And I sort of wanted to walk away from that part of my life. So going down this hallway, and I pass our apiculture specialist at the time, and he looks at me and he says, "Don't you have bees?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I do." He said, "Come with me, boy." So I ended up, you know, and went in there, and I became one of eight what they call regional apiculture specialists in the state. And I'm the last one of those standing now. They've all retired but me. And I am probably going to work 3 or 4 more years, according to my wife.
If mama ain't happy, nobody's happy.
Well, she looked at me and I said, "Well, I'm going to think about it. I'm going to go out at 62. And she says, "Nah, I think you're going to go out at 65. So I'll be 61 in September. So. Anyway, I've enjoyed that. I love my bee work. I love my bees. I've had them my whole life. My grandfather started me beekeeping when I was 6 years old. Wow. And took me out in the bee yard, and, you know, I'm standing there and looking at the bees and doing all, and he's, you know, when it was done, he said, "Son, I think you'll make a beekeeper." And, you know, I've been doing it ever since. I had my first bees when I was 8 years old. And I've had them ever since. And my wife and I have a sideline operation, and I chair Farm Bureau, Georgia Farm Bureau's Honeybee Commodity Group. So, and I've been lucky enough, been president of Georgia Beekeepers Association and Beekeeper of the Year. And my wife and I actually are one of two couples that were named Beekeepers of the Year by Georgia Beekeepers Association. So.
That's
sort
awesome.
Of a rare thing there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of fun with that, and it gets me invited to places too. So.
Yeah. Sounds like
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I got to be the recipient a couple of years ago of some of Keith's honey. They make a limited amount of some years. It depends on
and it was limited this year.
On their harvest, yeah. But they make a sourwood. Honey.
In the mountains, yep.
In
North
mountains.
Georgia mountains.
And it is, if you've not had it, it is has the most mellow taste. It's a lighter in color. Not white, not clear. It's a yellow.
Yeah.
Excellent taste. We had a wager on that year's UK and Georgia football game.
I got you.
He ended up with some country ham. I ended up with some honey. I don't know
Thank
if there
you
was.
Both won.
I don't know if there was a loser in the deal, other than Kentucky.
Well, I figured Jay's been such a gentleman about that, and Georgia sort of steamrolled Kentucky that year, and I felt kind of bad about it. And I said, you know, he introduced me to broadbent ham.
Yeah. Yep.
And we enjoyed it so much, I told my wife, I said, "I have got to send this man some honey." I said, yeah. "We're just going to reciprocate on this thing." So I appreciated that. And every time I pass through that area of Kentucky, we take a cooler with us and we refill and restock the freezer. So
home county is the county that they started in. Broadbent's country.
Broadbent,
that was my home county.
Wasn't far from where you live right
that's
now.
Right, that's right. That's exactly right. Yep.
Broadbent's owned that. That was since bought by the Drennens, and they relocated and have it in the Catawba exit there.
Yep.
But still a great product.
And oh yeah.
It ships well. You can get right on their website,
right.
And I have when I lose a wager, that's what I send to people.
Right. Well, if you keep on betting on Georgia and Kentucky football games, you're going to have to keep on spending money on country ham. I can tell you that.
I'll be honest. There's a ham producer in my hometown, Donnie Penn, Penn's Ham, which is also another excellent ham. And I have giving those out to people on different times when I've won. just to pass along the goodwill. But country ham's a big product in our state, and we have a long-standing tradition with it. So,
well, you've made some friends, because I have actually turned around and did the gift packs for a number of people for Christmas presents. You know, mm-hmm. you got a favor, somebody let you hunt on their property or whatever, and lets me put some bees over there. So I started placing those things around, and I'm starting to get calls back, and they're like, "Where'd you get that?" Mm-hmm. And I tell them, I said, "It's on the package." Yeah. You know, and kind of wonder about folks sometimes, but you know, I've got a lot of people that are ordering and getting it shipped in, and
right.
UPS guy stops by my place one day with some of the sausage, and he says, "Man, what in the world's going on with this place? He must be having a sale." He said, "I like delivered 10 or 12 different things." And I said, "I bet I can tell you who they went to today." And he said, "Yeah, you're right."
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Keith, I know that, explain to the folks that may not know, Jay has alluded to it, but like different flavors of honey.
Oh,
tell
Lord
us about how that works. I mean, how do you place those around in different places but explain to the folks about that.
Well, in Georgia, we've got a number of different varietal honeys, and they start down on the coast. Now, the folks in Florida will argue with you that they are the only ones that produce Tupelo honey. Well, if you look at the species of Tupelo that we harvest what's marketed as Tupelo honey from, it's Nyssa ogeechee, the scientific name. William Bartram discovered that at the mouth of the Ogeechee River in Georgia. So I have a little fun with my Florida friends over that, and they say, "Oh, we're the only ones who got it." I said, "Yeah, why'd Bartram name it after a river in Georgia then?" it's a really neat varietal. It's got a nice fruity flavor, a little smokiness, a little woodsy tone to it, golden. And you hold it up to the light, and it's got a greenish cast, almost like motor oil.
Really?
And you can see it literally. As a matter of fact, Florida has a hard time producing it sometimes, and as Georgia does, weather related. Mm-hmm. But it's one of them, I tell people, you can identify that honey at 60 miles an hour. And somebody just looked at me like, "What in the world?" And I said, "Well, we were just south of Wewahitchka, Florida, in a little burb down there called Honey, Florida. And the guy had a roadside stand. And that year, the Tupelo harvest was really off, and we're running, my wife's driving 60 miles an hour. And I told her, I said, "Stop, turn around, go back. That man's got the real thing." And it was sitting there in the sun, and you could see that greenish cast in that honey, you know, sitting there. But that's one of them we do. Gallberry has been a big one for Georgia. There's literally been thousands of tons of gallberry shipped out of South Georgia from Ilex glabra, inkberry, some people call it. It's even worked, the plant's worked its way into the landscaping trade now. But it's, as my daddy used to say, it's got a wang to it. It's got a real prominent note up front, and then it kind of washes out to a real nice smell of honey. Sort of a medium shade honey, produces beautiful yellow wax. And it's another one that's really weather centric. That plant, if it gets a hard thunderstorm when it's blooming, it's done. The flowers are gone. Moving on up the hill, we have sourwood honey in the North Georgia Mountains. Blue Ridge is really a good concentration of it. You can get up above 2,000 feet in elevation and produce a really good, complete sourwood honey. People call it the queen of southern honeys, and I think that's probably true. It's got a vanilla buttercream flavor with a little spiciness on the end. Sometimes it gets a little basswood in it, and it gets a little licorice note on the end of it. But it doesn't matter. And people actually will fake it. Because the flavor is so prominent, they can blend it with corn syrup. Mm-hmm. And cut it literally. And actually, we've had some people that have been open feeding corn syrup while the nectar flow is going on, and so they can say, "No, I didn't. You know, we didn't cut that honey with nothing. The bees did." But there's some of that going on, and it's very valuable. It's a high dollar honey. I mean, it sells for a lot of money when you find it in the North Georgia mountains, but it's very slow to crystallize. As a matter of fact, I've got some jars of it that are 12 and 13 years old that were in honey shows where we just put them up with a ribbon on them. Mm-hmm. It'll get darker over time. The honey's just clear as it was the day I put it in a jar.
Really?
But that's our big one, and it's another one that, you know, weather dependent, rainfall, beat the flowers off the trees. And if it's cloudy a lot, it won't let nectar down. Late freezes knock the blooms, you know, bloom buds out. And this year was not a great year, but there is a container of it in the NACAA auction. So it's out there for bid if anybody wants it. And the quality of it was good this year.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And people that don't understand about beekeeping and placing hives at different places and that kind of thing, kind of tell us a little bit, like, how many bees you have and just, you know, kind of go through some of that.
I got up to, I think, 75 colonies one time. Being the county agent, period, that was a lot of work. And then inheriting another county, my wife was like, "When will I see you this week?" Because I was actually at that point, I was using a red light and doing a lot of bee work at night. Mm-hmm. Bees don't associate red light with being a problem to them. Mm-hmm. So I can go out there and do the same thing at night that I do during the daytime. Just have to watch where I put my feet because of rattlesnakes. But you know,
you just lost David.
You out.
I'm out.
Yeah, well, me too,
I'm
for
out.
That matter.
But we got a pretty healthy snake population, and they love bee yards because you get a lot of little critters that come in there and feed on the dead bees that and on the ground, and those snakes will come in there and lay up and wait for the little critters at night. Then I occasionally find one coiled up underneath a hive, but that's just a part of it in the South. But anyway.
I
had a bunch of bees, too many, and I backed off on them. And now I run about 20 production colonies, and I keep some nucleus colonies on the side. That's about what I can keep up with and keep going good management-wise. I also use them to teach with. And just enjoyment. I mean, when I come in, and people ask you this, "How in the world can you relax around a stinging insect?" And I go to that bee yard, and sometimes I just take a chair and sit down and watch them come and go out of the hives, you know, and I'm smelling the nectar coming in and, you know, and all that. And I just sit there, and that, all that from the day just fades out.
Yeah.
And but it's a lot of fun. My wife helps me, although talked about earlier, my wife was beekeeper of the year. She's never gone into a colony of bees. And she looks, she said, I haven't forced her or done anything. But she's great support, and that's what she got that far. She was secretary of the association and treasurer and promoting and doing all these things. And she says, "I don't deserve this because I'm not a beekeeper." And they told her, and they said, "Yeah, you are." And says, "You have heard his talk so many times, you can do them." And she says, "Well, yeah, I guess I can."
That means my wife raises bird dogs. She'll love that.
Well, that was sort of the same thing when we had a bunch of beagles for years, and I grew up with them, and my wife was the same way, and she's like, "Yeah, I raise beagles." And but she did. But it's one of those things, you know. I got a great extension wife. And people don't understand that there is such a thing as an extension wife, because as an extension agent, you're asked to be places and hours you shouldn't be. You're asked to do a lot of things. You're tied up, and it's last minute, and you're supposed to be going out to dinner, and some guy's got a $250,000 problem you need to help him with. And she's one of them that says, go, that's what you do.
Yeah.
Well, I've got an extension husband. He's you know, there's such a thing as that, too.
And, oh, yeah.
And not long after I went to work for extension, I've heard him say before, he said, well, when she went to work for extension, I did, too. And because
definitely
he's helped me before on different things and followed around and it does kind of take the whole family.
My wife has washed dishes, mopped the floors, helped me cook. She has registered people at meetings, you know, and it's just, I'm a lucky guy.
Yeah.
We all are.
We all are, yeah.
Absolutely.
My kids have helped, too.
I think.
Oh, my son, before he went to college, was my labor force for a lot of years on the farm and home and at work as well, so.
I know one of our specialists told us years ago that extension had one of the highest divorce rates in the world in as far as professions, just simply because of the hours that agents have to put in. And it helps to have a very understanding spouse.
It does.
Absolutely.
Well, my niece, she likes to help, and she's a freshman in high school now. As a matter of fact, today's her first day of school, and she likes to come around and help, and she's interested in going into an extension as a career, and I could see early on I think she'll be all right, because she's, ever since she was pretty small, she'd hang right there with me and want to go and help set up and clean up and do all the stuff that not everybody sees that part.
You better get her recruited and locked down.
I know, that's exactly right.
We've talked about it on other shows, but you know, when you're in extension, you kind of have to have that, as David called it, that servant's heart. You know, you have to want to serve, and often our spouses are asked to serve just as much.
Mm-hmm. So that's the thing of not saying no, and always finding a way. And you know, that's what extension people are good at.
Yeah, I had, I was on vacation all last week, but I had a producer. I was coming back on Thursday, and I had a producer who was doing this educational event for his H-2A migrant laborers on Friday.
Oh, he said, huge problem.
He said, can you make it there? And I told him, I said, I'm driving in from Maine the night before, but I'll be there. Well, a few days later, he was on the phone with a producer in my former county that I'd worked with forever. He said, you know, I hope Jay makes it. He said, but he's driving in from Maine. I don't know if he will or not. And to me, it was one of the best compliments I could have had. The other producer told him, he said, if he said he'll be there, he'll be there.
Yep.
And that's what we get known for, whether we want it or not. And those of us that show up and not only show up but stay, and long after the meeting's over and be there to walk our producers through things are the ones that's the relationship building capacity of these jobs.
And that's when you get to that point, and when you see that, when we do that, that's when you can start to see the impact of what you're doing. Not because you want somebody to say you're doing a really good job, but it's, you can start to see that you're helping people, and then once you ever do that, then you want to continue to do that.
You do, and it's one of those things when you can see people prosper from the information you've given them, the help that you've given them. I had the biggest compliment I have ever had paid to me in my career with our chair of our animal and dairy science department sitting at the table, and I had a producer look at me, and he looked over at him, and he pointed his finger at me, and he said, you see that man sitting right there? He said, he makes me money. And I'm like, and it was I just got this feeling that came over me, and I'm like, you know, Mike, that was the best compliment you could have ever paid me. And by the way, thank you for doing it in front of the department head.
Great timing.
Great timing. That was a wonderful placement for it. But that's it. When you got a producer that'll come back and say, you make me money.
Yep.
You can't get any better than that.
Yep.
You know, Keith, you talked a little bit about the different types of honey, the different flavors of honey. As a beekeeper, what are some of the other products you produce besides honey? You mentioned wax colors.
Yeah, we do beeswax. We make beeswax candles, sell a lot of beeswax candles, and we sell a lot of beeswax. One of the things now that I'm selling a lot of wax to people for, all these people have gotten into cast iron cookware and gotten into the, you know, the griddle type cookers, and I'm not going to mention trade names because there's a bunch of different ones out there now, but they got to season that stuff. And we've got a lot of folks around in Georgia now that are rehabilitating old cast iron. So I'm getting calls from them, and one of the ingredients in their product for seasoning these cast iron implements is beeswax. So it's just like, it seems like every day another one's calling us and saying, hey, I need 4 or 5 or 6 pounds of beeswax. And in, it's gotten to the point where I'm actually having to buy a little bit from folks I trust, you know, to be able to supply them. But it's one of those things that, and wax, the candles are beautiful. They smell wonderful when they burn. We also collect propolis from our hives, and propolis is resins, that tree resins that the bees collect, and they'll combine it with wax and a few other items that they produce out of their own body, and they use it to sterilize everything in the hive. They seal cracks with it. As a matter of fact, I even found a lizard that had gotten into a hive one time, and they couldn't drag him out, I guess, after they stung him to death. So they propolized him in place and just mummified him in propolis. So, but it's one of the oldest known antibiotic and antiseptic compounds. It works great for humans. I'll get a little ball of it about the size of a marble. And if I got a sore throat, I'll just kind of stick it back between the cheek and the gum and just suck on it. It's kind of like sucking on pine tar, about what it tastes like. But it will heal, you know, you've had mouth surgery and stuff like that. It'll help heal it up in a hurry, and sore throats and sort of an analgesic too. But a lot of people making tinctures out of it. So there's a lot of things we do with them. I have a few people that I don't sell them to them. I give them bees for apitherapy. I actually do apitherapy myself. My old fingers, I busted them up playing ball when I was younger, and I'm getting arthritis in them, and my left middle finger looks like a old 6 ounce Coke bottle. But I can bend it, and it's because I do sting therapy on them. I actually do it myself. I get a bee and hold them and make them sting me and on the joints and whatnot, and it, your body responds to that. And it, they say it helps break down some of the scar tissue in there from the arthritis.
Yeah, I've read that.
So I can tell people it works if you can stand being stung. But being a beekeeper from young age, God, I don't know how many times I've been stung. People, how many times you been stung? I don't know. I guarantee it's over 1,000. And as my wife looks at people, and she says, he doesn't even swell up anymore. And but it's, you know, it's one of those things that, and it's getting to be a growing thing as a product. And I've seen people that have had muscular dystrophy, and they've gotten relief from it and been able to walk because of apitherapy.
I've read a lot. You know, we have somewhat of a movement going on across the country. It was there before the pandemic, but it's certainly grown afterwards. Of natural medicines, natural healings, natural eating, and I see the prominent role that bees play across all of those. Honey, you know, has long since been used for folks who have allergies. Folks wanted that local. They wanted that local honey, so that they could get those antihistamines and make use of and what's those, there in their own area.
And that's absolutely true. The enzymes in honey, and if it's a regional problem that you've got, grass pollen, whatever, because they pick all this stuff up. We got a lot of bahia grass down there where I live, and I get calls from folks with bees, and they say, I got honey that's got little black specks in it. And I start laughing, and I said, they sort of elongated. I said, now they're picking up bahia grass pollen, you know, which is black, and they pick it up and take it to the hive. But all those enzymes from those various plants that they pick up nectar from or pollen from get transferred in there. And those enzymes, over time, if you're eating raw honey, they do help you start to tolerate these things that act like an allergen to you. And with honey, too, it's such a helpful food product. It's 30% sweeter than table sugar. Therefore, you use less to get the same amount of sweetness. And the baking industry has used it for decades because it's hygroscopic. It holds moisture in a baked product. So the better bakers have learned, these ladies and gentlemen who win these baking contests have learned that the moisture in that honey helps keep a cake or, you know, whatever, you know, muffins, whatever, moist over a period of time. And I tell people, they said, you know, I don't like eating honey. I said, you eat honey every day. No, I don't. I said, yeah, you do. I said, tell you what, if you had a baked product, look on the back, and if you see it says glucose and fructose on there, you're eating honey. Yeah. And they're like, what? And I said, yeah, people, there's a lot of people that eat grocery store honey, which is gross. That stuff, oh, Lord. That's just nasty. But they, you know, they eat this stuff, and it, and they get a bad taste in their mouth, literally, for it. You know, I don't like honey. So the bakers don't put honey on the label, but FDA says, okay, well, we can say glucose and fructose and go right along because that's basically what it's made up of. But talking about that health-wise, there's a lot of people with diabetes that can eat things like sourwood honey and tupelo honey because they are 100% or nearly 100% fructose. So your liver breaks it down. Now, there's some problems if you dive into that deeply, but if you use it, you know, just
small amounts,
like, and enjoy that, you can, as a diabetic, you can enjoy a little bit of sweetness in your life.
It, and it's very much one of the reasons, and I've always been a honey fan, but now it's one of the only sugars that, that I'll eat when I can. A little bit of it goes a long way,
it
just
does.
As you say. But the thing about it is so pure, my body will break it down and it be gone pretty quick.
Yep, and it, and energy-wise, it's one of those things you see a lot of runners now are building honey into their beverages that they use when they're running. I don't know what you call them, but you'll see them put honey in those things because you on a rounded energy spike. You don't get that wham, wham that you get from sugar, but it just kind of eases you up and you can stay on that slow glide and then down off the other side of it. And you don't feel that sugar slam that I call it where you're just like, ugh. You know,
I think the technical term those runners use is carb loading.
Yeah, there you go.
Carbohydrate.
I knew you'd know it.
Yeah. My nephew's a runner, and he's running actually at Morehead State. And I learned a lot about their meals in there and what they, you know, what they're supposed to eat so many days out they have to eat.
That's how they do it.
Yeah, it's like you have to eat red meat so many days out, and then you're eating so many carbohydrates and ahead of a race. And do you have any experience with putting with bees around canola?
Yes, ma'am.
That is one. So I have a producer that raises canola. He wasn't a beekeeper, but just as soon as he started raising canola, he had beekeepers, you know, want to come up to him and ask about putting hives over by the canola because they said it makes really good honey. And that's been something that they've done every year. There's always, if you look, you'll start seeing hives around their canola.
Yeah, back when we had really high diesel fuel prices, we had a biofuel processing plant in Georgia. And they were also, now it's just turned into an oil processing plant, but we had a lot of canola for a number of years. It does produce a nice honey. The biggest thing for beekeepers is it's early. It's the earliest nectar source you're probably going to have in quantity. So yeah, it's a huge thing for beekeepers to get them on it. I tell people it's got a really nice flavor, and if you have a really good sense of taste, you pick up just a hint of collard green on the backside. So that kind of ruins it for people on it. But the one thing about it is very quick to crystallize. So, and we used it to make creamed honey, which has gotten to be a huge thing in the market. You know, taking your lemons and making lemonade, but you control the crystallization by introducing a starter crystal that's a very powdery, very small thing. So you get a honey that crystallizes with about the grit texture, I tell people, of toothpaste. It's just very, very small crystal in there. And you can flavor it and do different things with it. One of the ones that we did and still do is a cinnamon flavored one. We were at a little farmer's market one morning early in April one year, and it was cold. It got down in the 20s that morning, and everybody was going to the little place and getting coffee out of it, and they ran out of sugar. And so I went over there and I put a couple of bottles of honey, and I told my wife, I said, you know, maybe this will get folks coming over here. And I put a jar of cinnamon creamed honey up there. Well, the lady that was running the little coffee booth came over and she says, have you got any more of that cinnamon honey? And I said, yeah, we do. And she said, well, I want to buy a jar from you and put it back. I said, no, take this over there and put it up there. Well, people were stirring that cinnamon honey in the coffee. And we sold every bit we had and were taking orders for it after that, you know, from folks on it. But it's one of those things that, one of those food products that's so versatile. You know, they're doing different things with honey, the creamed honeys, and, you know, you hear people call it spun honey, but that's just when you take creamed honey and put a sheetrock mud beater in there and stir it up and loosen the texture up on it a little bit. But it's just a neat product. I mean, they produce so many things, and it's the only creature in God's creation that produces a food that we eat. And people say, well, how about cows? Well, yeah, they produce milk, but they're a mammal, you know, but it's the only insect out there that produces a food product that we eat. You know, I mean, there's people that eat bugs, but it's the only insect we have that produces a food product. And then these other byproducts, the wax and the propolis that we get from the colony.
I have some chapstick, actually. One of the beekeepers in my county, they was just trying some new products and doing some candles and things, and just brought some by the office one day and left it for me. And chapstick was one of the things that they were doing, and I really like it.
Side items are endless.
Yeah.
Soaps, hand lotions, you know, all these things, salves and creams, are all based in beeswax and have honey in them. And I can tell you, when I'm extracting, I'm getting beeswax on my hands, I'm getting honey on my hands, and my hands get so soft. I mean, my wife's like, how come your hands can't be like that all the time? You know, because, I mean, I get, my hands get rough as a cob, but, you know, it's just one of those things that people have discovered it. And even as a hair wash, I mean, honey can do lots of things for your hair. You go to the National Honey Board website, and they've got tons and tons of recipes on there for everything from running drink beverages to skincare products to recipes that have been tried with the quantities of honey and baked for efficiency and cooked and everything, you know, so you won't fail when you use those recipes.
Do y'all most of y'all's marketing, is it through farmers markets, or do y'all have it there at your house?
We of course sell out the door from the house, but we do a community farmers market every Saturday, and we get such an eclectic group of people coming through the county that it's amazing. We of course a lot of Verbos and Airbnbs out there around that Lake Oconee, and those people are there for a week and they're looking for, you know, buying local. And they come to the farmers market, and we see new people every week. It's really a strange thing from where we first started, and it was the same bunch of locals. And now I see new people every weekend, and that's basically where we go, and word of mouth, and it's hard for me to keep up sometime with what we've got.
pretty neat.
Well, I'm sure. Well, you know, looking ahead, when this show is going to finally air, which will be sometime around mid-September or so, give or take, we always like to wrap things up with a timely tip.
And, there you go.
And Keith, give us a really good one today. And seeing how where everything else is being harvested that time of the year, he says it's a really good time to start our hive preps to start moving into the fall and winter months. So, Keith, you want to expound on that a little bit? What producers need to be doing?
I'd look at, especially in your area, in September, I would definitely be looking at getting my hives winterized. If you have not done varroa mite treatments, you certainly need to be doing them at that time. We've got a number of products available out there now that will do a good job for you. If you need to harvest honey, you need to go ahead and do it at that time, but also make sure you're leaving enough stores on those colonies to get them through the winter time, or at least well into winter before you have to feed. If you've got light colonies, ones that don't have a lot of stores, you need to feed them. My recommendation, especially for your area, probably be feeding them a 2-to-1 or either a 3-to-1 sugar to water ratio syrup, sucrose syrup. I'm not a huge fan of feeding corn syrup. If you can get corn syrup that's edible for them, you know, yeah, you can use it, but sucrose is a better syrup. Nectar comes into the colony in the form of sucrose, and then they enzymatically broken down into the various sugars, mainly fructose and glucose. So it's a product that they're familiar with handling, and they can also eat it directly. Make sure that you've got your hives located where north winds, northeast winds are not going to chill them down. I usually set them just under the crest of a hill. I don't put them in creek bottoms where they're going to be wet and get a lot of moisture. I want them up on a hilltop where we got some kind of tree line break or something to break them off. Look for weak colonies and combine them. Don't take weak colonies in the winter because they're going to end up creating problems for you. And get all that stuff done, and, you know, understand too that as beekeepers, we lose 20-30% of our colonies every year. Most of that is, of course, due to varroa mite damage, but management also, I see a lot of bees starve to death. And I tell people, monitor them through the winter, and when we're starting to come out in spring especially, don't forget, okay, well, they're still asleep. No, they're not. They got to eat and produce energy to keep that hive warm. And pay attention in the spring and feed them. Don't be afraid to feed your bees, because there's one end point if you don't, and that's death. And I see as many bees die every year of starvation as I do from people not treating for varroa mite. And the combination of the two is deadly. If they're eat up with mites and they're also low on rations, then you can guarantee your bees won't make it through into the spring.
You know, you mentioned under a hill or the top of a hill where they can have some type of protection from the wind. In and around woods, do you have problems with, like, raiding predators as well? I'm assuming in North Georgia where you've got some bears.
No, actually, my county's eat up with bears.
There you go.
Bears have spread across the southeast. They tell me they're one of the most rapidly expanding wildlife populations in the country. Of course, feral hogs, you know, are a problem, but they're an invader. But the black bear's population is getting huge. I've had colonies torn up in my yard by bears. I see bears quite frequently in the county. They, you know, get tear up cornfields and whatnot. So it is what it is. But it is a time to look at pressures from things like that. Feral hogs I've had come rub on colonies and, you know, I've had one big boar knock a colony over, and he was just kind of rubbing on it and messing with it. I think it was an accident. I don't think it was anything deliberate. But bears are becoming a real problem throughout the southeast, and if you've got a threat of bears in your area, now they get sleepy where I live, but they don't hibernate.
Correct.
You'll see them all winter long. They're not crawling in a tree stump somewhere and going to sleep. They're up and moving around all winter. So it would behoove you to have a good electric fence with a good effective ground on it. You know, use a high gauge, high tensile strength wire for your ground rod. Cattle producers understand that fact. Mm-hmm. Beekeepers will just take a piece of the fence wire and run it to their ground rod, and they don't get enough ground potential on there to knock mm-hmm. that bear hard when he hits it. You know, but make sure you got a really good effective electric fence if you've got predator problems around your area. And of course, the bear is the worst one. The other predator is the one that walks around, drives a pickup truck, and walks on his hind legs. And, you know, just like anything else, people will steal your bees. So I try to keep mine out of sight.
Yeah.
This is a very litigious world nowadays. So when I can keep my bees out of sight and people don't know they're there, mm-hmm. They're not going to claim, one of your bees stung me. And I've had that 4 or 5 times over the years that somebody's wanting to blame me for being stung by something. It was probably a yellow jacket. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of keep them out of sight, and I keep them protected from critters that are going to get in there. Mm-hmm. But don't forget that two-legged one that drives a pickup truck, because they will find them and steal them. And I've had yards vandalized. I had several times people just go in and push hives over because they were visible. And I have had people shoot them with high-powered rifles. And, you know, just being mean. So keeping them out of sight. Yeah, there's plenty of it. But that's one of the things, unfortunately, nowadays, you, as a beekeeper, you really need to think about in how you place and set your colonies. And I try to keep them out of sight of roads, you know, and keep them safe from the predators.
That's a good place to end right there. Mm-hmm. So, Keith, we appreciate you a bunch.
Glad I appreciate you all having me.
Glad you were able to be here and be a part of this. We want to thank you for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week on our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters, and Georgia Ag matters too.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.